Chair Richardson. Good morning.
Good morning.
What we were going to do today is finish up talking about the outcome measures for teen pregnancy and then talk about community safety net, and we are hoping to go through child protective services and foster care so that we can stay on task to allow time at the end of the week for the priority discussion. So Sue Abrams will continue where she left off yesterday. And for the record, I'm Ramona Foley, Assistant Director, Children, Adults, and Families.
Thank you. Ms. Abrams.
Hey, Chair Richardson. And for the record, I'm Sue Abrams, Administrator of the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits. I'm just going to finish up the teen pregnancy prevention with the performance measure, which we do have a slide, which we're obviously doing very good in that performance measure, and have reduced the teen pregnancy rate since 1996. We've reduced the rate by over 47%.
So what do you attribute that reduction?
A lot of things. There isn't one thing that can be attributed to doing this. But what we know from the research is that it takes a comprehensive approach. It involves families, communities, schools, our efforts, you know, healthcare services. So I think it's a whole host of activities that we would attribute that to, but not one thing.
Would you mind just telling me how you determine the number of pregnant girls? Is it by delivery plus abortions, or is it by what happens at the end of the pregnancy? How do you know?
Chair Richardson, this is compiled by health services and vital statistics. So my understanding is it's the pregnancies that are reported, plus they do an analysis of the abortion rates, and that often takes us some time to gather that data, because I think they also look at what's happening from in other states surrounding Oregon to get that data.
Okay, so it's interesting data. I'm glad we're doing well. I just don't know how we actually would know unless you take surveys of high school girls every Monday morning.
Yeah, and Chair Richardson, some of the data we use is from what's called the Healthy Teen Survey, which is a national survey that is conducted around the nation in schools. Unfortunately, but it's often hard to get the data because schools sometimes don't want to participate in the survey because of the type of questions that are asked. But that is where we get the information on what gives us a picture of what teens are doing, what things are looking like for them around not just the risky behavior of sexual activity, but others like drug and alcohol use and those kinds of things.
Okay, thank you.
And then the committee had a question as to, why we're using this as a key performance measure, and then talk specifically about DHS's role in affecting this measure, and especially since it's not a big budget item. Now, it isn't in terms of a line item for CAF. It's a small budget item. But what we know that does impact the teen pregnancy rate is health services. And clearly in the department, we provide a lot of health services, which is a big ticket item for us. However, what we don't do is just have a line item that says this is the amount of money we spend just on teen services and just on reproductive health services. But things like family planning services, access to health care services, school-based health care clinics, all of that plays a big role in helping to reduce the teen pregnancy rate. Specifically, and I had mentioned earlier, the kinds of work we do in CAF is really provide that technical assistance. We are able to kind of call out the research and then provide that technical assistance to local communities, through the coalitions, through schools, provide resources and information to parents that kind of help support these efforts. So, and if there's no other questions on teen pregnancy prevention, I'll move on to the community safety net.
Okay.
The community safety net was a program that was started in 1996 in response to concerns about families who are reported to child welfare but did not their situations did not rise to the level of intervention by Child Protective Services, but wanting to be able to connect them with other services in the community that would help reduce the chances of them eventually coming into the child welfare system. It started out as a pilot and eventually went statewide in all counties. What we do is provide a small grant to the counties, and they in turn are able to provide a resource where people can connect with the families that have been screened out of child welfare and then do some level of assessment. And it's a voluntary program, so if families choose to participate, then we work with them to connect them to the appropriate services in their community. It is a small grant, and the expectation right from the beginning was that and it's also kind of run by a steering committee, and the expectation is that the other services and resources in the community would come together in a coordinated fashion to provide services and help to these families. And in most communities, that has worked very well.
Would you mind taking a minute and just explain to me how the referrals are made? I mean, who makes the referrals, and two, who coordinates these other community resources?
Chair Richardson, the referrals are made through the child welfare system. These are families who are they're screened out of. The referrals made to child welfare, but they don't rise to the level of child welfare being involved with a family, so they're screened out. And then a referral is made to the agency that is getting the funding for Community Safety Net, and then there's a person there who will get that referral and make the connections with the family. And then the steering committee kind of takes the leadership in bringing the local entities together to work in a coordinated fashion.
The steering committee?
Yeah, the local steering committee. Every
talking about children and families, what steering committee? Every county, every community, every city? I just don't know.
Yeah, it's in every county. There are 36 community safety nets, and every community safety net has a steering committee that's attached to the community safety net. Yeah, the steering committees have we've identified sort of a mandatory group that we want to come together, and part of the commission. So the Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Human Services, are sort of the make up the and then the whoever's the fiscal agent at the local level make up the core of those steering committees, and then locally they'll bring other entities into that as is appropriate for that local community. We do have three outcome measures for the community safety net. They're to reduce child abuse and neglect, increase family stability, and promote connections among families, community supports, and agencies. and then this relates to the Oregon benchmark for the number of children abused or neglected per 1,000 persons under 18. We have struggled with being able to kind of assess this program. Part of the reasons is that there are variations among the counties on how they deliver the services. We also struggled early on to get common data, and so several years into the program, we were able to move to a system where we do have some common data that we capture on all the families that every community safety net then transmits to the central office, and we are able to put that in a database. We now have the raw data, but we have not yet moved to doing a full analysis of that data. So that's kind of our next step.
Okay, I'm looking at appendix page 6. It says victim rate chart, and it shows a trend of increasing numbers of victims over the last 4 years. And can you explain why you think the trend is going up, or am I misreading this?
Yes. No, Chair Richardson, you're reading that correctly. And when we talk about Child Protective Services a little bit later, we will be highlighting some of the reasons that we know that victim rate is increasing, the reporting rate is increasing. We believe one of the reasons to look at Community Safety Net is because of the way the state has chosen to spread the money across 36 counties. In some states, there's that federal grant that underpins this particular program is used in one or two sites. So it's much more strategically directed to see if you can make some impact. I don't think the community safety net itself is the big contributor to the increase in the victims rate. I do think some of the things we'll talk about, like drug use, for example, incarceration, are contributing to the higher victim rate. But I do think it makes us pause to say, how is community safety net, if it's not impacting that rate, then how do we measure what it is impacting? And because it's a voluntary program, as Sue said, it's very hard to get data, and it's a small program, so we don't want to put more money in the evaluation than we're actually able to put into the service itself. We have been in conversation with the Commission on Children and Families to talk a little bit about, and when we come back for phase two, what are some of the options we might want to look at in terms of how we can measure any outcomes from the community safety net.
Thank you.
Just to end, and I do think we're going to talk more about that in phase two, but while we haven't been able to get the kind of evaluation out of the program we'd like, there is some recent research coming out of the University of Maryland's Connect program that is a kind of intended to do the same kinds of things that Community Safety Net was, and there's some real positive and encouraging information coming out of that model that we're really going to take a strong look at for where we'd want to move our community safety net. So with that, I think I'm done unless there's any other questions.
Any questions?
No, I assume, Mr. Chair, we are going to have a longer discussion about child abuse and neglect later in the presentation. We can go into it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, what a nice segue. We'll now hear about Child Protective Services.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, refugees. I forgot one more program. Marge is coming back. My apologies. And then we'll go to Child Protection.
We'll digress away from Child Protection for a moment. For the record, I am Marge Reinhardt, the Administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs in Children and Adults and Families. I am batting cleanup on the self-sufficiency part of our program and our presentation. And I wanted to talk with you for a few minutes about the refugee program. The refugee program is a federally funded program that provides resettlement services to newly arrived refugees in the United States. It is a program that's been around since the early 1980s and began with Southeast Asian, primarily resettling Southeast Asian refugees after the Vietnam Southeast Asia Asian War, and has moved or evolved through the years to moving away from primarily resettling Southeast Asians, moved into resettling former Soviet Unions as the Union refugees as the largest number. We are now seeing a trend where we are still resettling a large number of former Soviet Union refugees, but we are also seeing an increasing number of Africans resettling in across the United States and in Oregon as well.
I might just lead off by saying I spent some time last session with a Russian family that had newly located in Salem area, and they thought that this certainly was a wonderful system because they could move in, qualify, I believe, for Social Security benefits because he was in his 60s, get food stamps, housing, and it was all just given to him. And so it'd be interesting to know what has to be done for to retain those benefits, to contribute toward the system and not merely be a drain. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a segue into the service structure in Oregon. For the majority of our clients who are...
Senator,
I'm sorry.
Just out of curiosity, I'd like to have an idea of what's the difference between an immigrant and a refugee. I mean, refugees from Southeast Asia came here because they had assisted us in a war and were forced out of the country for political reasons and came here as refugees, didn't really want to be here necessarily, and we had a responsibility towards them, which continues. Immigrants are people who choose to come here, for the most part, and choose to come to our country. And certainly from Africa, I understand that there's a real refugee problem there. I'm not sure people come from Russia are refugees anymore as they are immigrants. What is your definition of a refugee compared to an immigrant?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, there are a couple of questions within your question, I think. The first is the difference between an immigrant and a refugee is essentially what you have described. A refugee has status that is granted by the Department of State, the Federal Department of State, and is roughly defined as a person who is fleeing some form of persecution. The former Soviet Union, initial refugees were generally Jewish and or Orthodox and were fleeing religious persecution in the Soviet Union. So that is basically the definition, the difference between an immigrant and a refugee. So a refugee is a person who receives legal status through the Department of State and their sort of arms and affiliates around the world, and is granted that status and is then placed in a sort of a pipeline to leave the country they are at and resettle somewhere in the world. And the United States is not the only place that resettles refugees.
I understand that.
For the former Soviet Union, and the reason that we are continuing to resettle those people is that that pipeline is very long. And so that a number of these people have been waiting several years to move from their country. They've gone from their country to a refugee camp somewhere and are waiting for admission to a country to resettle.
Mr. Chair? And just to state the differences between a refugee and the services they get and an immigrant, could you comment on that? Because they're very different.
They are very different. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson. They are, and that sort of, I can describe for you, refugees receive have a particular status, and so as they move through, whether it's social service benefits or other sorts of benefits, their qualifications for those are a bit different. What I would like to, for the refugee program itself, and in response to your first question, Mr. Chair, the refugee program provides cash assistance for a maximum of 8 months, the first 8 months that the family is in the country. During that time, they will receive medical assistance and food stamps if they're otherwise eligible, and a cash assistance grant that's consistent with the standards which we use for the TANF program. But at the end of 8 months, a refugee no longer qualifies for those benefits. For that reason, the refugee program as it's structured in Oregon is highly employment focused, and so that as essentially from the time a client or a refugee we meet them at the airport, and by we I mean our social service net of providers, we begin to work with them around employment and employment needs and the services that they're going to need in order to quickly become employable, because they are on this 8-month timeline.
But a follow-up to answer my question, it was my understanding, and that's why I wanted you to clarify, that immigrants have their own sponsors and aren't necessarily able to qualify for the same kind of benefits that a refugee. Now, is that correct or incorrect?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I will clarify this for you. An immigrant is a person who comes, as I understand it, independently to the United States. And in terms of their I would have to let you know about the different programs that they qualify for. A refugee comes with that particular status and qualifies for those sets of services as a refugee. At the end of that 8 months, there is the possibility for further we do have a chart that can provide you with the difference between immigrant, the programs that an immigrant can qualify for.
So Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that I asked that question. I think it's taking up too much committee time. We'll give it to Mr. Smith later, okay?
He would like to.
I don't think there's any general fund money in this program at all, is there?
There's no general
fund.
It's
all federal
funds,
right?
That's right.
So, but I like to just. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I shouldn't ask even ask the question.
It was, Mr. Chair, it was a good clarifying point because there is confusion between immigrant status and refugee status in a number of ways.
Just wanted a quick answer. All morning.
Okay, we can move on.
Beg your pardon.
We would like to have a copy of that. I'd like to have a copy of that sheet, if you could specifically.
We'll provide that chart for you. In Oregon, the program, the refugee program, as Senator Bates mentioned, is federally funded and is administered through local contracts with faith-based organizations who administer the social service and cash aspects of the program, and with the immigrant, IRCO is their acronym, and they changed their name to match their acronym. Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, the Portland-based organization that provides employment services for refugees. And those are employment and employment preparation services in order for them to move quickly through into employment in the United States.
Question. Do you have any outcome statistics to show how quickly they do move from the time that they arrive and get service and to when they secure employment?
Chair Richardson, Senator Williams, Williams, where'd that come from?
I don't
beg
know.
Your pardon, Senator Winters. The performance measures for the refugee program are federally driven. And so we work with the federal government to establish those. In terms of, and in your material, there is a chart that shows our outcomes for the last fiscal year, and these are based on the eight that it is on
page nine
in the performance measure section tab.
While they're turning, can I just ask a question on the administration? It's all federally funded. Are we receiving compensation for the costs that we incur as a state in administering it?
Yes, we are.
Can you tell me what kind of money we're talking about?
The total budget, I don't have with me the breakdown on administrative. The total budget is about $9 million a year. The cash assistance portion of that is about a third. And so the balance of that goes into health screenings, which are part of the federal requirements, into the employment and the other social service programs that help the refugee to resettle. In terms of state staff, we have just two staff who administer the program, and so they are the people who work with the federal government and the local contractors and do the state administration of the program. I would have to get you the administrative costs. Out of that $6 million, I would have to get for you the administrative cost breakdown.
Mr. Chair, and I recognize that this is a federal program, and it's a program that is administered by the state. And I'm asking for these outcomes because what I'd like to look at is to see a couple things. One, as how quickly a person who comes to this country with limited skills including language barriers, what it takes for them to get employment. If I take on the flip side and I begin to do some comparison with those who are from this country and who is educated through this country, and I think somewhere that kind of data exists,
mm-hmm.
whether the feds are compiling that kind of information or whether you have it with that. And also along with that, it would be helpful for me if you give us some comparisons with other states so that we can see how successful or not successful or where Oregon fits in with those other states who are also engaged in these kinds of programs.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I would refer you to the chart on page 9. The first two columns are basically those families who are here for the first 8 months. There are some employment services that are available after 8 months. There's no more cash assistance, but that second column is people who are continuing to take advantage of the employment services. Behind the performance measure tab on page
right.
9.
Children, adults, and
children,
families,
adults,
yellow
and
tab.
Difficult.
Go to yellow tab for children, adults, and families. Mm-hmm. Then go to the white tab, performance measure, and then go to page 9.
And I can the number served in that initial 8 month period, adding those two together, it's a little over 1,200. 60% of those people are employed within that 8 month time period. I don't have a breakdown prior to 8 months. I can see if we can get that, but that is those would be the percent of people who are employed within the 8 months of arrival in the country. The other comment that I would make on that is that we and we will certainly look at other states as well. Much as I talked a bit yesterday about the client demographics within the TANF caseload, within the refugee population, the trends change in terms of a refugee's employability when they arrive in the United States. When we were with our large numbers of former Soviet Union resettling refugees, a number of those people came highly skilled. They had been doctors or nurses or engineers in their home country. Obviously, most of them could not move directly into that, but they were highly skilled and had very competitive work histories. Other populations are pre-literate, meaning they have no written language in their native country. They are farming peoples, and so they will. So there is a great variety within the refugee population as well, just as there is within our TANF population in terms of their employability.
Okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The refugee cash assistance ends after 8 months. Refugee TANF ends after 8 months. If 60% of the people are getting employment, what happens to the other 40%? Are they eligible for a regular TANF, or what programs are available for the people that aren't finding employment, or the people that if they've got limited work experience come back into an unemployment or dependent status 6 months later?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the refugee program resettles both families and individuals. For families, if they are otherwise eligible, they could receive TANF after that 8 month time period. For singles, there would be no cash assistance program within the state of Oregon for them, unless, as Chair Richardson described his meeting with the former Soviet Union refugee, if they do qualify for supplemental security income or Social Security, they may be able to receive that. But in terms of an employable single adult, there would be no additional cash assistance available.
Okay. Please continue.
Actually, I think in response to your questions, I guess the only other thing that I would mention, I talked a bit about the Department of State and their management of the influx of refugees. The numbers after 9/11, the numbers of refugees dropped dramatically. Those have risen slightly. We resettled around 1,600 refugees in the past federal fiscal year. In this coming fiscal year, we expect that number to be slightly under 2,000 for the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
And if there's no other questions, now you can flip your hats back to child abuse.
Okay, now we'll start on the child welfare side with Child Protective Services.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services children, adults, and families. And I will spend some time this morning describing the Child Protective Services Program and supportive treatment services under that program. What I would like to start with is an overview of Child Protective Services, and then I'll refer to some of the outcome measures, some of the charts and appendices that we have given you, and then I'll go back to a description of the Child Protective Services Intervention and Treatment Services. So I'll be starting on page 11. The Child Abuse Reporting Law was enacted in 1971 and has been updated several times since that date. The law was designed to provide early intervention and protection of children who experience abuse, neglect, or threat of harm from abuse. When a report of abuse comes, there are a couple of agencies identified to receive reports of child abuse and neglect, and those are law enforcement and the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, Child Protective Services. When a report is received, child welfare and or law enforcement may respond to that report. The allegations will be reviewed to determine if child abuse has occurred. What will happen when we make a face-to-face contact is that the child protective service worker and or law enforcement will determine if the child is safe, and there will also be a determination about whether or not abuse or neglect has occurred. As the assessment and the investigation is completed, that determination will be made, and we will call that founded, which means that there is reasonable cause to believe that child abuse has occurred. We may call it unfounded, and that means there is no evidence of child abuse was identified or disclosed. Or we may end with a finding of unable to determine, which means that there are some indications of child abuse, but there is insufficient data to conclude.
Senator, you're slipping back and forth through this manual. Can you tell me where you are in this?
I'm just on page 11 now.
Past the blue pass. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I have not started. I haven't started with that. I'm sorry. No, I haven't started there. I'm just on page 11.
Page
just
11.
Yeah. Page 11 of the behind the, yeah, of the
blue tab.
The blue tab. Page
the blue
11.
Tab. The original blue tab.
Yes.
Right. No. Yeah. Some of us who are chronologically advantaged can't follow this very convoluted book.
Chair, I mean, the way this book is set up, we've got Tennessee, different tabs working under various details, so we're flipping back and forth trying to follow them. I hope you bear with us, okay? So, I've seen all this and read through it, and I got to go back and find it again. It is not easy.
Certainly. I apologize, Chair Richardson. Would you like me to go back? Would it help if I went back over some information, or should I go ahead?
I think just
Okay. So I'm still on page 11, and so I've just finished what our dispositional findings might be. If when a call is received by staff that we call screeners, those are the people that receive calls of child abuse and neglect, and it's not assigned for face-to-face contact, we would call that a close-at screening. So CPS Child Protective Service caseworkers identify and provide services to children to keep them safe. Whenever possible, the caseworker and other members of the team work in collaboration with the family. They prepare an action plan to provide safety for the child and use the strengths of the family. So that's just an overview of what our process is. So what I'd like to do now is move to the chart that you see. And I'll also refer you to a couple of other pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, and then I'd like
to... Okay. We're on page 12 of the actual charts in the PowerPoint presentation.
Yes. So page 12 of the chart that's up on the screen. And then I'd also like to have you reference the appendices, page 5, page 7, and page 8. and I'll be talking about those as we move through this particular chart. The total population of children 0 to 18 in Oregon is 875,790. That's just to give you a perspective on the number of calls that we get. In the year 2004, we got 46,524 total child abuse and neglect reports. And I'd like you to reference now, there's a small box just to the side of that particular part of this diagram that says 33,989 families were subject of a report of child abuse and neglect. And so what that means is that we receive that number of calls, but we receive multiple calls on some families, and we also receive sometimes more than one call on the same issue. Mm-hmm. 22,995, 49.4%, were closed at screening, and I described that earlier. 23,529, a percentage of 50.6%, were completed assessments, and those are the assessments that we do either alone or with law enforcement where we make a face-to-face contact, we do a safety assessment, and we make a determination of whether abuse or neglect has occurred. And again, that additional piece, that represents 18,397 families.
Do you, Mr. Chair?
Senator Winter.
Do you have the percentage of those that are multiple? Some of the calls are the multiples included in this 33,981 stats?
The multiple calls are included in the 46,000, and when we look at how many numbers of families, that's 33,000, and then those are the number of families that have received a call, and that is the breakout of there may have been multiple calls on that family. And yes, we could provide more detail. I don't have that today, but we can certainly go to that level of detail.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we move down the chart, we see victims of abuse or neglect. And so of those assessments that we completed, 7,307, or a percentage of 31.1% of assessments, were founded for child abuse or neglect. And what I'd like you to know is that founded determination is based on the family. Then we'll move to the victims. So there were 10,622 total victims. And you'll see a box on the side that says the unique count. Duplicated count was 11,759. And what that means is there may be a child that was a victim of two different kinds of abuse on a founded disposition. Questions about that?
No. Well, just to verify, you're saying there's 7,307 individuals involved, but if there was, but some have multiple counts, so if you added the counts, that's 11,759 total instances of abuse involving 7,307 children.
Chair Richardson, no, let me clarify that further. The number 7,307 is the count of families, and there may be one or more children in those families.
Got it.
I have a question and clarification.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you look at the total victim number as a percent of the total calls, is it, I mean, less than 25%, 22, 23% of them turn out to be legitimate calls? Is that right to say?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, What happens, yes, is that we have a total number of calls. Of those calls, there may be there is a certain percentage that we would close at screening and not respond to. Then there are a certain number that we do a face-to-face assessment on, and we may be determined that what was called in is not accurate, there is no abuse that occurred. And then of that final percentage, you'll see the victims and the families where we have a founded disposition.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, that issue is an interesting issue in child protection because around the country, most cases that are called in, most reports that are called in turn out to be unfounded. And so it does cause us to wonder about that as an approach. Some states have gone to a different kind of intervention point because we're still using resources even though the case is unfounded. And it's also a traumatic issue for families, even if it's an unfounded case, that there has to be some intervention. So that's something that as a profession, child welfare consistently is revisiting that to figure out, is that the best approach of all? But as I say, a couple of states are trying some innovative ways of intervening so that you move away from that 25 to 30% of the cases being founded.
Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really a tricky part of the system. It can be devastating for a family to be accused of child abuse and be investigated when, in fact, they've done nothing wrong. And yet you don't want kids to slip through that are in danger and miss that.
Right.
And I don't know how you really approach these things. I mean, I, on a regular basis, call in and have to report families. I'm required to as a physician. And many times I'm questioning whether there's a real problem. And you know some of the issues involved, an ex-spouse who's angry at one or the other and wants to accuse the other, neighbors who may not know the whole story. On the other hand, I've had at least two cases where requests for investigation said nothing was wrong. One ended in the death of a child. And so it's something that I still don't feel we have a good handle on, and I don't know how you get there for sure. And I would like to hear a little more about what other states are doing just for a moment, if you could, and be real specific, not, you know, you're very good, Ramona, at say, kind of, you know.
Being delicate.
Don't be delicate here. Tell us exactly. I mean, I've laid out for you. I know a case in my practice where we turned a child in three times and then the child ended up dead. Okay?
Yes, Chair
Richardson.
I know cases
where parents have been unjustly accused, and it's devastated the family for years. So.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, in states that have tried a different approach, it's usually called a dual track or a multiple response system, so that at the front end, rather than the assumption being that this will be an abuse or neglect investigation or assessment, it's more of an intervention to say someone believes this family has a problem. We need to intervene. We need to find out whether or not there is a problem. And then certain topologies, such as sexual abuse and physical abuse, go automatically into an investigation scheme or an assessment scheme, and others would be treated more as an intervention to interface with the family and say, do you have a problem? We understand your children aren't attending school, that they've been left home alone, whatever those kinds of issues are. And Missouri is one of the states that has experimented with this a bit. There are a couple of others. It's still untested. There has been some evaluation of the process in Missouri because that's been in place a few years, and we could get some of that information. But I think the concern you raise is the concern throughout Child Protective Services, and that is a lot of harm can be done by intervening if intervention is not necessary or required. And yet, the way our laws and the way our policies are set up, they are created to protect children so that if there's going to be an error, the error is supposed to be in terms of over-intervening rather than under-intervening in terms of safety of children. But we can get a little more information, something like a one-pager, if you'd like, on what that intervention has looked like in other states.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that'd be fine. We'd like to have that. Your use of the term over-intervention is describes the way it is, but as legislators, I get no emails indicating or contacts indicating how grateful people are for the intervention of CS, you know, for Children's Services representatives, but I get frequent, meaning monthly, instances where the clients, the families, have felt that they were being dealt with in a heavy-handed manner, guilty until proven innocent, and all under the guise of it's for the kids, which certainly is important, but that can be used to cover a multitude of sins. I would think that your caseworkers must be, and certainly have to be, very delicate in the way that they approach this, because they're dealing with families, and there's different standards of care, and while we have a responsibility to watch out for the children, we also have a responsibility not to devastate families and their reputations and so forth merely because there's been an allegation. Would you explain what is meant by the word dual in these other states? I mean, does that
yes, Chair Richardson, dual
doesn't start the whole process of the government or what?
Dual means that in their law, what they have done is they have recognized that an investigation may not be the only approach to take with working with families. And so dual means that they may be allowing themselves to intervene to deliver a service without it having to be the result of a child protective service investigation. Most states, like our state, the intervention is an assessment or an investigation. So most states don't have a recognized second track that you could actually go to visit a family, look to see what the problems are, and not put it through an investigation or child protective services track. So that's the use of the word dual.
Okay.
And Chair Richardson, I too, most of the emails I get, most of the calls, are from families who feel pretty devastated by any intervention on the part of the system. There's probably not a part of human services more emotionally driven than child welfare. And I think the struggle our staff have is if they don't intervene enough and we end up with a bad outcome, they will read about themselves in the newspaper. And then if they intervene too much, and we end up with a bad outcome, they will read about themselves in the newspaper. That word precision that I used yesterday, I think, is very critical because we have to know exactly what we're doing whenever we knock on the door and what we're going to be offering for those families.
It is a delicate balance. Senator Winters.
Thank you. I'm really interested in, Ramona, this whole dual track or function more like a triage to where you can deal with people without them getting into the stigmata that occurs when you talk about the investigation of child abuse and neglect. The other piece in it, my historical hat, comes on where, you know, we have moved from where when we talked about an abuse and neglect as abuse being very physical, neglect was where you're taking and starving a child and some of those issues, all the way into the whole total spectrum of emotional and some of those abuse, which quite frankly have been very hard to define because the professionals don't even agree. Which leads me into the other part of this issue, and that is the training of child welfare staff and whether or not the institutions are on board to do what is happening in Missouri. Because unless all those systems come into play, you know, you're educated one way to deal with the investigation and then here's something else. So I need you to comment on that because I know that that piece has a profound effect on how the staff do their work.
Yes, Chair Richardson and Senator Winters, we were talking this morning and I jokingly said, you know, the expression, it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to raise a caseworker. There's so many things a caseworker now has to know that really go beyond what we traditionally thought they'd have to know in child protective services. And you're absolutely right. The training, the ability to identify whether or not a parent is using drugs, if you're the only person who shows up at the door that day, and if you don't have immediate access to someone who has that technical skill to recognize that, I think we ask an awful lot of our caseworkers. Our training is done for caseworkers through a contract with Portland State University. We're going to be looking at that training. One of the things the national expert is bringing us is really an expertise around safety and whether or not the issue of safety is as strong in our training as it should be. I would point out, though, on the issue of the dual track, as we put together that information, one of the things that does create sometimes is an expectation that we will do more for families than what we currently do. At this point, if the case is not founded, as Una described, there's very little access to services for that family. If the case is founded, then the family will usually be offered services. almost always offered services. If we were to look at a dual-track model, and we can get some of those figures, if you make an assumption that someone thought a family had a problem and that's why they called in a report, then it may create an expectation that the system would be able to do something for families regardless of whether or not there's abuse or neglect. That's a training issue. That's a very critical training issue for staff to be able to define, you know, what is abuse or neglect and what is a family who is in need of a service. But it's something that there's been enough time now with the state of Missouri, for example, that we could certainly look to see what that budget looks like and what it looked like before.
Okay. We talked about the delicate nature of what has to take place and the balances. Talked about the training for workers. I'd like to know if there is in place a system for evaluating the conduct of various cases. For instance, is there a post-interaction survey with our clients, the taxpayers, those that are involved, asking them to evaluate how they were treated, how things were explained, were they given an explanation of what their rights were as far as their own children, those kinds of things, so that we know what client satisfaction there is, and also where there may be a problem with an individual who is giving a bad rap to the whole, you know, to the whole system, because those, it's the isolated cases of heavy-handedness that get circulated, not the successes, you know. And so what do you think?
Thank you, Chair Richardson. We do have grievance processes in place, and of course those are generally activated by people who have a concern, not people who feel like their case was handled well. We also have a review system called the Child and Family Services Review, which goes into each community, each county, is entitled to one of those reviews. It's based on some federal benchmark measurements, but we interview folks in the community, interview partners, interview families, interview foster families, to try to get to the information about how well they believe the case was handled. We try to break that into two things, though. One is we can know from data how well a case is handled, but that doesn't tell us whether or not people were treated with respect. And so what I think you're asking for is making sure we have measurements that say whether or not people are treated with respect, whether or not their phone calls are returned on a timely basis, and those kinds of issues. We certainly have a number of oversight systems in place as well in child welfare, and we'll talk a little bit about those as we move further into the system. But our cases, all of our cases where families lose their children to foster care, all of those cases go to court, and so court is another avenue for the due process of individuals who are aggrieved of a decision by the department. We also have CASAs, court-appointed special advocates, in about 30% of our cases, and they stand in place of the child. They're also looking to see how the case is being handled by the department. And for children in foster care, we have Citizens Review Board, which occurs every 6 months by statute for every child in the foster care system. And that's an opportunity for both parents and the birth parents and for foster parents to come forth and talk about how they feel about the services being delivered by the department.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winter.
Because there's so many entities involved when one becomes involved with the child welfare system, and I'm looking at costs and all this, do you have a simple, straightforward kind of information that that the average public can look at and see, this is where I go and this is what I need to do? Because the more we have entities involved in the delivery of services, the more complicated it becomes, and then citizens don't know where to go for what to get what answers. So I wondered if you had such a brochure or something that is distributed throughout the state, throughout the county.
Chair Richardson and Senator Winters, we do have some brochures available now, such as when a child is taken into protective custody, they receive a brochure that lets them know what the process is at that time, what they can expect when they go to court, what they can expect from their caseworker. So we have that information available. We have other points in the case where we provide information to the family about a process such as a family decision meeting. One of the pieces that we have in development right now is to provide information to the family at the point that we knock on their door to let them know what the Child Protective Service assessment is, what they can expect, who can they call if they have questions, what the outcome might be, and explain to them in detail what their due process is. I just wanted to add to what...
Before you go on, so is that presently being handed to people at that time?
It's in process right now. We're developing that because we see a need for that to be to happen.
Tell me, what happens when your workers don't follow your own internal due process?
Chair Richardson, Senator Winters, could you ask that again? I'm not sure
what
I understand.
What happens when your staff, when child welfare staff, when your caseworkers do not follow your own standards and due process?
Chair Richardson and Senator Winters, there's a personnel disciplinary approach that's done, and that's part of our agreement with SEIU. And that what does allow us to take actions in regards to a worker who does not follow policy or who does not follow the law. And we do that. Most of that information is not subject to public record. And so when those kinds of disciplinary actions are taken, it would be difficult for us to be able to say to the public, this is the action that we took. There are some restrictions around that by law.
Well, and you're saying by contract or by law, because it's too, I know the school district here in Salem is using the issue that happened with their one of their staff of saying it was a contract with the union. That is totally different than if you're talking about a statutory provision. And I'm hoping that what is not taking place in the public discourse, that we're not entering into contracts with individuals to get around the statute. I hope that's not what is taking place.
I'd like to make a point on that. If you would like to know if an attorney has had any complaints against him, you call the Bar Association, and they will tell you not the outcome, but any complaints, even if they were bogus, because that is the way it's set up. If you want to know about your doctor and you call the Oregon Medical Association, they won't give you the time of day because their approach is protect the doctors from disclosure, where from the lawyer's standpoint it is protect the people and by giving public disclosure. And so you and I both agreed that we get a lot of contacts where people feel like they have been treated inappropriately by their caseworker or by whoever's involved, whatever the title is of the person. And what you're saying is that that person can make the complaint, but they can't know whether or not there's been any consequences as a result of their perceived action. And if they can't get that kind of information, then they assume that it's all a closed deal and that the government is protecting their own and that they have no rights. Is that not correct?
Chair Richardson, a clarification. I don't want to imply that the caseworkers, that when disciplinary action is necessary with caseworkers, that there is no information whatsoever. There are circumstances, and I'm not a labor expert, so I don't want to go into what those would be. There are circumstances in which the agency speaks publicly about what that discipline was. But there are laws around the employment relationship that we have with staff as well as a labor contract. And we can certainly get more information, but I would not ever put myself out as an expert in that area and would want to talk with our human resources group to provide any answers to those kinds of questions about what is public information, what isn't. The difference with the Bar Association and with the Board of Licensing for Social Workers, for example, those are professional organizations, and they do have certain codes of ethics and so forth. Our caseworkers are not, for the most part, are not master's-level social workers. Our caseworkers do operate under the agreement that we have, the labor agreement, but they are not attorneys, and so there's not that same body of discipline that you would go to report the actions of a particular caseworker.
Okay, I guess what we're getting at is that we're discussing this is we know that there's a problem, and so we're kind of spending more time than expected, but the goal is to kind of flesh out what can we do to help restore trust. One is that maybe it's well-founded, and so we need to look at instances where these complaints are, you know, and see if there is a one office or a group of individuals who are getting more than their share of complaints, and that's a personnel issue. Maybe it's more public disclosure so that the people can find out what's going on and that we're more transparent. And so that's these are the kinds of things we're discussing. Just a moment, we'll have Representative Hansen and then Senator Bates.
Well, two issues. One, how many cases a year, how many numbers of disciplinary actions do you take over the whole, your whole workforce? I guess that would be something that would help me kind of get a sense of
Child Protection Services complaints actions taken.
Okay, Chair Richardson and Representative Hanson, you'd like us to get the number of how many personnel disciplines, not across all of social services, but just in the area of child welfare,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah.
We can get that information.
Okay. The other one, and that's just something that I learned from former Representative Leonard, was that he would always ask someone was complaining about children protective services to ask for them to waive confident, ask the family to waive confidentiality so he could look into the situation. And oftentimes the family would immediately stop asking him at that point. But
that's a good thing to do.
Because I know my, I know their there are incidences of...
There's also a fear of retaliation by some of these people. They say, no, if they know, then we'll be on their target list. So that is an issue.
Well, but, yeah. But it's a balancing act. But by the same token, sometimes if you're able to learn the full circumstance surrounding the case rather than just the what the grandparent or somebody has told you secondhand, that it becomes... a little easier to understand what the actions of the workers were.
Yeah, sure.
Representative Hanson, the new wrinkle in that, and I did have a case, and the parents did give the approval for me to have access to their information, but the wrinkle now is that if it's over in the DA side, we can't do it because of the DA. We can't access because of all these other pieces. And so, and I also know that the speaker had one that was similar. And so this has raised this whole issue of, in fact, the issue of whether legislators can have access to this information. And there's some legislation that's being drafted, quite frankly, because of all these blocks that have been put up. And I raise it because as legislators, you're asked to assist and to get information, and then when you're being blocked as well, that you can't access, even when the person gives you the authority or the approval to do so, then there's something that I think we need to address as policymakers. And also, I think we need to look at systems in terms of systems and how responsive those systems are, and at the same time making certain that they're protecting the individuals that they are that they're supposed to protect, and that's the child. So it is a balancing act, but it's if we're going to bring trust into the minds of the public, we've got to be able to balance that act and also provide the transparency that is needed so that the public then trusts us again. It's huge. That's why I asked about the Missouri model, what's going on there, and if they're doing something that enables them to achieve this higher goal, I'm all for looking into it.
Certainly. Senator Bates.
I suppose I should apologize for starting this entire discussion again, but I think it's an important discussion. And just a couple of points real quickly. First off, I am going to not respond to a trial lawyer talking about physicians and the Board of Medical
disclosure.
Examiners.
Disclosure. We're talking about disclosure.
Only to say that the Board of Medical Examiners routinely disciplines physicians 5 to 10 every month and publicizes that publicly.
It's public.
It's printed publicly, and they have a you have an ability to go in and ask for any disciplinary action against any physician in the state, and it's published material. And so it's there. Now, not every complaint, but every disciplinary action is taken is public. So
Same for nurses.
There aren't any for nurses, of course. But having said that, I'm still concerned about the children first here. And the reason I'm concerned is I believe the number of times that this heavy-handedness occurs in comparison to the number of cases that are investigated and then the number that are actually moved towards some kind of intervention in the families is incredibly small. What may not be present is some way for families who feel they've been mistreated to clearly have a way of stating that grievance and making it public knowledge. When I call in on a regular basis for families that I'm concerned about, I'm required by law to do that, and I would do it even if I wasn't, the response usually is appropriate. It's thoughtful, prudent, and careful with those families. It's rare that there's a heavy-handedness involved. I'm actually more concerned about going the other direction. That is not mean to say there aren't specific examples of these things that have happened that are much more concerning. And it's something you have to be aware of and work with and look at constantly over and over and over whenever a family's been treated unfairly. Because the effect on those children in that family, not only the family standing in the community, but the effect on those children can be devastating. Families split up for 2 or 3 years when nothing really was going on, and that's happened, is not healthy for those children. So I know you're aware of this problem. We bring it to your attention. Please continue to work on it.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, if I may, two things. One is there is a governor's advocacy office, and I think Cindy Becker mentioned that last week in the when she was doing the overall report about the agency, and it takes a large volume of complaints from families, and they look into that. That is part of the organization that has total access to all of the records, and they produce reports on how many complaints they're getting from which counties and that kind of information. It's very helpful to us in management. The other thing is there is a due process in place that we put in place about 4 years ago, and that is if you are the subject of a founded case, you do have a due process right to ask to have that reviewed. You can challenge that decision. You're notified in writing that there is this due process right, and it's an internal system, but some of those decisions are overturned at the local level. Some of those decisions are overturned in central office, but it is one more way that we try to make sure that the system is accountable, and I think that's the theme of what I'm hearing here is the whole need to continue to try to enforce accountability in a system that's this large and a system that has this kind of impact on families.
Yes, and I might mention it to Ola, if you're working on a brochure relating to due process that would be given at the time of intervention, that it would be wholly appropriate to include a clause that would say if you feel like you are being treated unfairly, then please call the governor's advocate or whatever. Not that all of them would do it, but that they know that they're not powerless and that they'd have to go hire a lawyer for millions of dollars. I mean, many times these people just feel like they have no power, no place to go, because they don't know that the governor, they don't know anything about it.
Right.
They don't know what the resources are. And so a phone number for an ombudsman or an advocate that could help clarify things for them would probably give a lot of peace. First, Representative Hanson, and Representative Hannah.
And Mr. Chair, don't forget me.
And Senator Monson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Skipping a little bit ahead, as I'm looking at the state and national comparison data that was passed out, there's a measurement of recurrence of maltreatment, which is based on maltreatment that has occurred after there was substantiated abuse. One of the measurements that would certainly be, I think, very helpful would be if there was a measurement of maltreatment that has occurred amongst the block that wasn't substantiated. So if we've got a report on a family and we find out that and the agency says it's unsubstantiated or there's not enough data to go either way, an indication of how well we would be treating these cases would be if there was later substantiated abuse that was coming in for families that had been previously reported. And I think that would be a good indicator of how our system is working and how well we're screening out the unfounded case.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanson, that's data that we have now, and we could certainly make that available.
Okay, thank you.
I'm actually trying to now move things along.
Okay.
So brief answers and brief questions.
Okay. Chair Richardson, thank you for that information, and I'll certainly follow up with the brochure. I'd like to just move quickly through the rest of the presentation.
Okay, no, we have two more questions.
Oh, sorry.
Chair Richardson, thank you. As it relates to, as I've reviewed the performance measures and outcomes, and as it seems this subject has merit and has traction to the idea that maybe we should be tracking the incidence of satisfied customers. In other words, there should be a performance measurement within here that said we had a complaint, we validated the complaint, we went through the process, did either an in-home or an out-of-home process, and at the end of all of that, that family ranked the performance of the agency in some way, so that it was part of the performance measurement. And when we have this conversation, you know, in the next biennium, there's a measurement point that we could talk about, because if it is important, and as you say, if we are receiving a large number of complaints, we probably ought to be able to track that, because large in my mind would mean 50% of the people or more are dissatisfied with their service. And if that's the case, we ought to be working on driving that number down. So we ought to make it measurable rather than just talk about.
I would agree. And I don't know how actually to do that, but I would ask that that be looked at very carefully. Not necessarily are you happy with the outcome, but the points that they need to assure that they had their rights explained to them, that they were treated with courtesy, that their questions were answered, that their phone calls were answered in a timely manner. Those indications that help determine that the state's representative was doing their job in giving public service, with an understanding that it is a very sensitive, you know, issue. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. And I'm sure you're very aware of it, but being a mandatory reporter and having worked with many case managers, and I would say 99.9% of the case managers truly are dedicated and respectful, et cetera. But when I would make a referral and I would work with the case managers, I would be so thankful if they weren't referred to one or two of them that just, you know, in our eyes, didn't treat the client with respect. But then I would go ahead and share that with, I wouldn't make a complaint, I would share that with the supervisor, and the supervisor then would talk. But there are some, oh good, it was referred to that case manager, great. So, you know, there are differences, but it's important for all mandatory reporters, if they're aware of that, to go to the supervisor, too.
Thank you. Okay. Our final question, Senator Winter.
And it's something you can bring back if you have it. I understand that it's a growing population of cases that are actually custodial in nature, where one spouse or one parent has custody and the other parent is trying to get custody. I talked to my local DA. If you have anything that suggests how many of your cases are there, what is if there's a growth rate, because that poses, I think, for this body to begin to look at, you know, really if there's some other avenues. If parents are using the abuse reporting in a way so that they can try to get custody of the child that the other parent had, that poses some different issues and I think some different remedies. And I know that.
Yeah. That's a good point. I would think that what you're saying is, if there is a, if it's a suspicious area, I mean, a suspect, and that is that, you know, there's divorce going on, those kinds of things, that there be additional indication, or that there be that it be looked at a little bit differently than if it's a doctor calling in who has no stake in the outcome. But you'll have to decide where we can go.
Chair Richardson and Senator Winters will be glad to give you some response to that in terms of the numbers.
Okay, thank you. If we can continue.
Okay. Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'll move along quickly. In terms of this first graph, I just wanted you to reference appendices number page 5, which is the total child abuse neglect reports, and it shows you increasing over time and gives you some information about why that increase is taking place. Page 7 breaks out the types of founded abuse, and this is for the year 2004. It gives you which kinds of abuse occurred. The one point that I'd like to make is that neglect or threat of harm neglect are obviously the most prevalent forms of abuse that we're seeing. And on page 8, you'll just see a similar chart.
Before you go further, would you identify what it takes to qualify as neglect? What, you said two things. You said neglect and
threat of harm.
Threat of harm.
Threat of harm. Those seem very subjective. So has there been any change in the definition of what constitutes neglect or threat of harm?
I'll read you the definition of each. Neglect is essentially the absence of what should be. Determined by, and we have a definition, neglect including failure through action or omission to provide and maintain adequate food, clothing, shelter, medical care, supervision, protection, or nurturing. Chronic neglect is a persistent pattern of family functioning in which the parent or caregiver does not sustain or meet the basic needs of the child, resulting in an accumulation of harm that can have a long-term effect on a child's overall physical, mental, or emotional development. We define further, we break out what physical neglect is, what mental neglect is, medical neglect, lack of supervision, desertion, and psychological neglect.
Okay. What I'm trying to get at, of course, is that we have an incline.
Mm-hmm.
We have a number of cases that are increasing over a reasonable period of time, 4 years, and so that indicates one of a number of things. One is that the incidence is increasing. You know, the bad signs, the moons, sun rays, whatever, but there's more neglect. Another is that there's just a better reporting system and we're finding out that they were there but we didn't know. And a third is that whatever we're doing is failing, that we are not lessening. It's like the war on poverty. If we're becoming more and more poor, then maybe the way we're doing things needs to be adjusted. And so I don't know which it is here as to why the numbers for cases of neglect are increasing. So that's why I'm wondering, have we changed the definition or do you know what we can identify?
I can speak to a couple of different contributing factors. Certainly in the area of neglect, what we're talking about is not, it's not an event, it's a life. And I think for us, in terms of the founding of neglect, we found perhaps an event, we provide services, and we attempt to get at the issue that may have created the situation where the two-year-old was left unsupervised, and we provide supportive services. And in fact, what we learn at a later date is that there is an underlying issue that is chronic to the contribution to the neglect for the child, which might be an undiagnosed mental illness, and certainly the issues that we've talked about in terms of substance abuse and specifically methamphetamine use contribute to the neglect of children over time. So that's certainly an area. And I think not only in Oregon, but I would say on a national perspective, chronic neglect is the hardest of all forms of neglect to address and to make changes. We, in fact, need a lifetime of support for those families. And the child welfare system is a system that provides more of a short-term intervention, and what we need for those families is long-term community support. The other part that might contribute overall to the growth in reporting, but also the numbers of victims, is that we have a better informed community, a better informed state in terms of what child abuse or neglect might be. We have increasing numbers of reports, and in turn, we have increasing capacity to know when children aren't safe.
Okay.
Chair Richardson, also in response to your question, the chart on page 6 in the appendices, if you look at what happened up until 1999.
I'm sorry. Just a moment. Senator Bates.
I'm going to break in and ask a question if I could about some of these figures just for a moment. Unfortunately, I have to leave it a little before 10. I read through this last couple of days. My looking at these figures say that about 1 to 1.2% of children in Oregon, according to your statistics, are victims of some form of abuse. Is that correct? Roughly that percentage?
I believe so, yes.
The question is this. Is this the tip of the iceberg, or is this a real number? And the reason I ask that is when we look at things anecdotally from a different perspective, women now report that at least one-third of the women in this country are abused sexually before the age of 10, 11, or 12, and yet that's 30%. You're talking about 1%. That's just one picture. My concern here is that truly we are missing a huge amount of neglect and abuse out there, and the system we have in place, after all the discussion we've had, is still missing the boat here. Adding to that is my concern that a week ago we're talking to people from Healthy Start showing how the families they're touching are having a reduction or leveling off of child abuse. We look at your figures, child abuse is going up. And we talked to them about their program and whether it was effective or not. It's a peer program, and maybe you're missing help. And everyone starts sliding around all of a sudden. And my concern is this. We look at this from different pieces every time I come up here. Everyone says things are going pretty good. Child abuse, by our own understanding, is increasing. And we're not even sure we're measuring accurately what's happening in our society. So the bottom line here is, do you believe these numbers? And have you looked at the entire programs you're offering as being effective? And that's a huge question. And I ask, just first off, respond to the question, whether you think these numbers are real for the amount of neglect and abuse going on in our society.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, that is a big question, but my answer would be that based on the severity of the situations that we're seeing in Child Protective Services, and I hesitate to say this, but also based on the resources that we have currently, my opinion would be that certainly there are more families that need protective services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'm not sure how we get that information.
No.
Mr. Chair?
I think that, you know, that is a huge question.
Yeah.
But the effectiveness question is a huge one, because we have everything continuing, and that goes to the idea of, if these numbers are continuing to ramp up, is what we're doing effective? Are we in need of changes in our approach? Is there a better model? Is Missouri doing it better? You know, is this societal problem being better solved somewhere else? And if so, are we just too entrenched and inflexible that we can't change, or should we change? And those are questions that we haven't answered yet.
Mr. Chair, it raises another question, and whether or not the definition of for reporting purposes from 95 to 2004 are consistent, or whether there's been changes in the reporting definitions, because that also has implications for your data sets.
Absolutely.
So one is, is it consistent with, or have they been consistent since 95? And I think it would be helpful for this body if they had a list of what the definition of child abuse and neglect is.
Okay. Chair Richardson and Senator Winters, overall, I mean, the law has been pretty consistent. We've had some interpretations and then some policy changes during those 10 years. And I think that's what you'd like to see, a chronology of what are the pieces that have happened that might influence this.
Right. Because you could have started out with in 95, where your definition of abuse and neglect was clearly physical and some of those and those kinds of issues, and then as you expanded the neglect category, what it is in neglect, and over time, you know, where we are today, and so that would have that would skew if it isn't consistent.
Yes.
Do you have this detailed information as to the areas of neglect and the number of cases? I mean, is that something that you have, so that we would know if, you know, how many are serious physical kinds of things, and then how the spectrum goes, and what the numbers are?
Chair Richardson, I want to be sure that I'm answering appropriately. We can certainly break out the individual types of neglect that are identified, yes. And is that what you're asking?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay.
And we can provide that information.
Thank you very much. Electronic form's fine. And you can just send it to us, whatever's easy for you.
Mm-hmm. And you. Chair Richardson, the thing I was going to point out on page 6.
We'll be able to move along now.
Yes. On page 6, when you look at that bar graph, often what you see in child welfare is it is a small snapshot of what's happening in the larger community. And if you see that in 1999, on that bar graph, we peaked in terms of the number of the victim rate of children, and the economy was better back in those days, even though that was just 5 years ago. And so you see a couple of years there where we actually, working with staff, we were able to put some clarification around threat of harm versus safety of children, and we saw a decrease there. And you will also hear later this morning in foster care, we had a couple of years when we had fewer children enter foster care than exited foster care. Those are very good markers in child welfare. And then what you see happening starting around 2003 is the climb starts back up a bit. And we believe, based on what we find in our status of the child report, that issues such as drug and alcohol abuse, problems related to mental health of parents, mental illness, for example, issues related to incarceration, some of the methamphetamine, we do believe that what's happening in the larger community in the state will also be seen as markers in child welfare, and that is not at all unusual in child welfare systems around the country. So we have now more children coming into foster care than we have leaving. We have more victims of abuse or neglect than we had 3 years ago. So I think it still bears your point, Chair Richardson, that we have to continue to look at how we're doing the business, the way we do the business in child welfare. I've often said may fit fine for families from the 1970s, but families have changed. They don't look like the families from the 1970s. And I think it really calls upon us to be open to looking at what are the better strategies, what are some of the best strategies, state-of-the-art strategies for working with these families. Thank you.
Continue then. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'd like to move to the next slide very quickly. That slide basically reiterates the number of calls that came in and then identifies the number of victims that were that we founded dispositions on, and would reference the appendices, page 6, that Ramona was just mentioning. I'd like to then move on to the next slide. And this slide speaks to what we were just talking about briefly a few moments ago. It's the re-abuse rate or recurrence of maltreatment is the national term. And it is the national standard that helps us identify how we're doing in keeping children safe. And the definition would be that we have a child who was the victim of a founded disposition and then within a six-month period of time is a victim of a founded disposition again.
Do you know the number for 2004?
We don't have the 2004 numbers available yet, published yet, but we're calculating those, and I can get that information to you. There's a six-month lag in the reporting of that.
Okay.
So the goal, the national goal is a percentage of 6.1, and that goal is set by the Children's Bureau, and it basically is an accumulation of the reports from all states that report to the Children's Bureau, and it represents the 90th percentile of all the data that's reported. The information that was last available on the national level was that the national average was 8.9%. That was in 2001. We do not have new information on the national level. We have met our goal, but the most recent information available to us would suggest that re-abuse is increasing.
Ask a question. In comparison, your chart to and the number one entry says reoccurrence of maltreatment, and then it shows Oregon for 2001 at 8.7, and then it shows 2004 at 7.6. So is that an estimate, do you think? Or is the
I believe that and I want to check back with our researchers. I believe what is listed there is 2004 is actually 2003.
Okay.
But so I'll need to check on that.
If that's the case, that would affect the whole column.
Yeah. You know where Mona is?
I don't.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject here, a lot of times what happens is that if
the agency is pulling data from a federal report that's based on a federal fiscal year. And so, for example, federal fiscal year 2004 is from October through September, as opposed to probably this is either a calendar year or a state fiscal year report. So on the performance measures, so the data could be just a slightly different time frame, which might account for the discrepancies in the numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And the final information that I would like to cover has to do with the Child Protective Services Family Treatment Interventions Grant Opportunities and Treatment Services. Under the Protective Service Program, we have a person that's a drug and alcohol coordinator, and that person oversees contracts for addiction, what we call addiction recovery teams. And those teams are located in each SDA in the state, and they are a mix of contracted and social service specialists. And they include a social service specialist, an outreach worker that is a person that can assist caseworkers in when they're working with families that have identified substance abuse issues, intervening early and providing transportation, actually going to their home, making sure they get to their appointments. Then we have also on that team a person that is a certified alcohol and drug counselor, and they, these people are not doing alcohol and drug treatment services, but they are assisting our casework staff in making the best use of the limited treatment resources, assisting families in getting in to the most appropriate level of treatment. In addition to that, the Child Protective Services Program has funding for domestic violence and sexual assault. We fund through this source 46 sites that provide crisis lines, crisis response, emergency shelter, and other services related to domestic violence. In addition to that, the coordinator of this program works closely with our program staff and has developed a practice guideline for our casework staff in working with families that have identified domestic violence issues.
Okay, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair. I just can't help myself here. But when we're talking about this percentage of abused and neglected children who were re-abused within 6 months, I guess I'd like to hear what you think the largest impediment is to getting to the national goal, and then I question a national goal of saying 6% of those kids are going to get re-abused. I mean, of those children who come to the state who, or who get through the system to a reported neglect or abuse, can you imagine their loss of trust in a system where they're the ones who go back and get reabused? And if I read this right, we're sending 54% of those kids back into the same home where they got abuse. And though the trend line is slightly moving in the right direction, maybe we've got to rethink how we're going about that. Because if you're one of those kids that are in the bad part of that percentage, I just can't fathom how we're getting there. And to say we're going to, you know, agree that the goal is 6%. I mean, I'm thinking there, realistic or not, the goal is zero. You don't want any of them reabused. And I'm just not sure that we're setting the bar high enough there, and I'm not sure what the impediment is, but I'd like to hear what that might be.
Certainly, Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, I appreciate your comments, and that would certainly be our same concern. The things that contribute most to the reabuse of children, again, were probably the greatest majority of those children. It's a reabuse in the neglect category. Pieces that contribute to that are the drug and alcohol abuse, unemployment, and parental involvement with law enforcement division. I appreciate your comments about returning or having a child remain in the same setting where the abuse occurred. Probably the greater perspective on that is that we also work very successfully with a number of families where there may have been an initial abuse. We provide services, and those families remain intact and are able to parent their children without a future event. So there are issues. I think a biggest concern to us is our capacity, as Ramona mentioned, to identify accurately and in a timely manner the underlying issues that are contributing to the initial abuse, being able to intervene with those in a timely way, access resources, and then make the change that's needed.
Paula, I want to make sure keep my notes straight. So the major impediments are the drug and alcohol abuse issues, interaction with law enforcement by the parents, and capacity to identify by the agency. Did I miss any major bullet points?
Representative Richardson and Representative Hanna, those are the major issues that contribute to events of re-abuse.
Thank you.
And Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, if I might add, the 6.1% or fewer, that number is selected by the federal government because what they do is look at this measurement across the entire country and then set a standard. You're absolutely right. The standard is a zero tolerance level in child protection, but that number is sort of an artificial number created by how well states are doing, and it simply gives a baseline to measure against.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is the standard. I sit here and those are excellent questions. But they're questions that also I think we need to ask our communities. There's only so much that the government and state agencies can do with respect to this issue. You know, we have a going out of the roof methamphetamine drug problem in the state of Oregon, and it's affecting every last one of our communities. I'm sure caseworkers can tell you and this body can tell you that that has a direct correlation with the abuse of children. We decide whether or not we're going to put how much or how little resources we're going to put in really to protect children in our state. And this body's going to have to make some decisions as to whether or not we do have such programs as Healthy Starts and relief nurseries and what have you. There's has always been this kind of this assumption that somehow when children are born that parents know how to nurture children. I think that could be furthest from the truth. We didn't come with roadmaps. And so what you see, and yet as a society, we decide that we don't want to provide tools with individuals to teach, to nurture, and to train, and to do some of those things. And we see some of the fallouts, and this agency is having to be responsible for taking care of, because we say children should be taken care of. And there's another piece of this. As that agency intervenes on behalf of children, and you ask yourself what resources exist for them to place children. I mean, where are the foster homes? Where are the group homes? Where, as children graduate through this system? And so I think from community to community, we need to start having the discussions in our communities. What are we doing as a society really, truly, to protect children and families? I think this is probably one of the biggest single policy issues that this state needs to face. And it does tie into unemployment and some of the other issues. Because if you're not employed, you know, you tend to get very agitated and we do other things. But I do think high on our list is how do we protect children and families in this state?
Well, I appreciate all your words. I think that the question is not how will we protect the children, but how do we assure that children get protection? The fact that parents start parenthood without any training is not new. I mean, it's always been that way, and if you look at, you know, at our society when things have worked better than now, you had a time when families were more intact and where there was more involvement, multi-generational, you know, where grandparents in the home are close by and all of these things, and we have changed in our society in the last 40 years a major shift from a family unit where you had training that was not overseen or provided by the government but was done within homes. And as we've seen a deterioration in the family, I think that we have seen certainly an increase in the detrimental effects in society, and there is only so much that government can do, but we need to do all that we can.
I think, you know, some of us were very blessed to have had parents and grandparents, you know, two parents, and we know that that isn't the way society looks today. We can either decide that we're going to try to make the best of what's going on in the society and recognize that, one, we're more transitory than we ever were as a society. Does that mean that because grandparents aren't here or my parent isn't here that we just let this go by the wayside? I don't think not.
No, essentially, when a parent is out of the home, the government steps in as a surrogate and can't do quite as well, but it's a reality. Moving right along. Thank you.
Chair Richardson, in light of the time, I'd just like to say that the remainder of this page speaks specifically to grants. It speaks to the family-based services program, which are the contracted services that we use in terms of making reasonable efforts and attempting to work toward reunification plans with families, and would reference appendices on page 3 to talk more about the family-based services program. And with that, unless there are other questions, I will go ahead and finish.
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. And so we'll move now into the out-of-home care or the foster care program overview.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I'm the foster care manager over at Children, Adults, and Families. I want to walk you through our out-of-home care section of your booklet. It's very clear to me that the committee has read the information and knows very specific questions you'd like to do, so I will try to do a fairly high-level overview of the out-of-home care section and then get right to performance measures and some of our appendices, which I believe actually address many of the questions that are being raised at this point in time. And so in recognition of the time, you will cue me when you need to, I would trust. So I will begin by saying our first slide that will be going up on the screen for you is really the slide that talks about the overall average daily population, because that's the first question folks talk about, is how big a population are we talking about. So as Ramona shared with you yesterday, we are talking about 7,400 children on an average day are in state care and custody, and that is within foster homes, that's within our residential treatment centers, our group homes. It's that whole gamut of children that are physically out of their home in our care. And that also represents about 13,000 children who experience our level of care in a given year. So those are all the children that Una had spoke to that actually come into the system. Over 13,000 experienced some level of out-of-home care last year. When I speak of out-of-home care, I'm speaking of children that are in family foster care, and that's a real common thing folks know about, is a family foster care. It also encompasses then children that are in our residential treatment centers for assessment or treatment and evaluation. The premise of it is that when children actually come into our care, they are coming into our care through the legal custody. So the court is actually ordering these children into our legal care and custody to provide care for these children. What we've seen over the last several years certainly was a significant piece that we were very proud of, that more children were going home than they were coming into foster care. And as Ms. Foley talked about, was that in 2003 we started to see that change a little bit. So this next slide that will be up on the screen will show you exactly the numbers that we're talking about and where our flip has gone back to more children entering care than exiting. And in 2004, it's a significant number. It's 1,000 more children who came into the system than left. And so when we talk about the squeeze and the pressure on the system, that's exactly what we're talking about, is that my resource pool of foster homes available has not grown dramatically to that same level. So we have a lot more kids that we are working with in the out-of-home care section at this point in time. It is still the goal and mandates, both federally and statewide, as well as community expectations, that when these children do come into care, they are coming into care and are hopefully, if all possible, staying in their communities. The goal is if a child is coming into care in Grants Pass, that child stays in Grants Pass. If the child is coming in Pendleton or in Portland, they're staying in their same neighborhoods whenever possible. The goal is to make sure these children are staying connected to their families, the continuity of school, and continuity of friends and relationships that they actually have in those same communities. That's not to say we do 100% of that at all, because we do struggle with the resources and trying to find places for these children. When children are actually going into a family foster home, what we are providing for a family foster care service, so that's single mom caring for foster children, that's mom and dad caring for foster children, it's a family type setting. It's somebody adding on one more children to their household, or two more children, or three more children. the families are actually providing really the basic room and board. They're providing clothing, school, personal incidentals. They're the ones that are providing that extra $6 for the field trip on Friday. They're the ones also providing, you know, the $35 for soccer club that's starting up next week. Those are the kind of things that our foster parents are actually providing. It's important, and I've heard it spoken of earlier today and yesterday, is that our children in our care are actually getting the same privileges and accommodations that other kids in the same society are going to get. So they are the kids that want to go to band, and they are the kids that want to go to soccer class and whatnot, or soccer school. So when we talk about the programs in overview, I'm really looking on the phase one, the blue section, and I'm actually on page 15 at this point in time through the out-of-home care. I've listed actually a number of different programs there when we talk about defining what is family foster care, what is relative care, family foster care, emergency care. If you note down there, there's a paragraph that's indented, bulleted there called special needs. You would best be served by just crossing that out. That miraculously appeared in that section there. It has no context there, and it doesn't even define what special needs children are. So that's an error in the document itself. We then also have other programs for our adolescents, because when adolescents are in foster care, they too are needing other skills and other services to be provided to them. So we have independent living programs, which are geared towards helping these youngsters learn things such as work skills, such as study skills for education, such as being able to start thinking about housing. What is it going to be when they actually grow up and are on their own? We then have a subsidy program and a therapeutic foster care, which is really directed towards kids that have a higher level of need in foster homes than just your typical, what you would consider your mom, pa, foster home. Some of these children have significant needs. They're being served in a family setting, which is actually oftentimes more or is better for these children. The residential treatment programs component then also then talks about we serve children through shelter care. And those shelter care programs may run from 30 to 90 days, and that may be actually an evaluations-type center for the child. So we may not know what this child's all their needs are. All we know is that this child's having significant behavioral or emotional problems in a family setting, and so they may actually be into a residential-type shelter evaluation to give us then a better understanding and assessment to say, this child is going to need some residential treatment services that may take up to a year, or this child, given the supports that could be added to a foster home, can be returned to a foster home setting. The other component within the whole out-of-home care arena is really interstate compact. And you'll see on page 17, there's a brief statement about that. And interstate compact is a national program where we enter into agreements that if Oregon children are being placed into another state, Tennessee, Colorado, whatnot, then those states are actually going to be providing home studies to us and supervision and guidance for those children in those states. And we then reciprocate that by doing the same for states when the children are placed here. I would then turn you to the section that is performance measures and outcomes. And as we've talked about in child welfare thus far, is that I'm going to start on page 10 of that performance measure area called at-home care. The federal government outlines through our Child and Family Services Review critical elements that they want to be measuring. And so there are four in the arena of out-of-home care. And on the handout you received earlier today, at your request, we actually compared Oregon to the other states. The other states were identified are Idaho, Washington, and Alaska, and that's merely because that is our region that we are in through the federal government. And so those are the close comparisons to our states. Through the measures themselves, incident of child abuse or neglect in foster care, this is a significant area for us. And as Representative Hansen noted question to Una earlier around CPS, is this standard should also be zero. It should not be at 0.57, so less than 1%. It still should be zero. The fact of the matter is, as Ms. Foley talked about, the federal government establishes a benchmark and starts measuring people as a baseline. The fact is, we need to do better, and we won't do better until the actual number is zero. We've had a number of things over the last year or so that we've actually been looking at, and the incident of abuse in foster care and neglect is really increasing, and we do not quite have a handle on yet all the factors that go into that. Clearly, the needs of our children are increasing. The complexities that these children are coming into our care with, are very significant, and that is taxing our foster parent system. It is taxing our residential treatment system and being able to serve these kids adequately. Many of the children...
Just a moment.
Yes.
Do not our neighboring states have similar problems? I mean, it's not a problem unique to Oregon, and yet we're showing a growth of a percentage. I'm looking at 2002 at 0.45%, 2004, which is actually fiscal 3-4, at 0.84%, which is like a 44 or 45% increase. What would be the cause of such a rise in such a short amount of time?
Yeah. Certainly for here in Oregon, part of our struggle is the complexity of children coming in. Other states certainly surrounding us, I'm not sure exactly how they're measuring as far as updated information. I don't know what they're tracking in 2003 and 2004.
I might also add, Chair Richardson, that one of the things that we have that's a unique qualifier is when we go into a home, if the abuse or neglect allegation is around one particular child in that home and there are other children residing in the home, our approach is more inclusive in terms of threat of harm to the other children. Some states only measure just the one individual child who might be a victim. That continues to be one of the differences in our measurement compared to other states. The other thing that Kevin mentioned is I think the stress that we are creating for our foster families. Cornell University did some research years ago and said that the number one reason for abuse or neglect of children in foster care is because the match of who the parent is we select to care for the child compared to that child's special needs, that match is not made appropriately to start with. And right now, our counties are telling us it's not a matter of matching. They're trying to find a bed when a child has to come into care as an emergency. They have to place that child where there's a vacant bed for that child to go in within the certification of that particular family. So we have long left that ability to say, here's a child who has special needs in the area of ABC, and here's a foster family who can meet that. So it really is a stressor in our system right now.
Okay, I see all that. I'm looking at, actually, it's close to doubling in the last year or two. And so are you saying that this rapid, dramatic increase in Oregon is related to an overstressing of the current foster family availability?
Chair Richardson, yes. I think that it is consistent with the chart we were looking at earlier, where the number of cases is going up, the number of entries into foster care is increasing, and as those numbers increase, and as I said 2 days ago, or yesterday, I guess, the number of foster families has not kept up, even with our ability to try to recruit, because when those foster families adopt children, many of them leave the foster care program. Ideally, we should have the selection of four different families when a child comes into care. We don't have that kind of selection opportunity now. We actually have to use whatever the family is that has an available place for the child. And so, yes, I do think it's consistent with what we're seeing in the child welfare system these 2 years.
Okay, well, what you're saying is the classification is incident of child abuse and or neglect in foster care.
Yes.
And so you're saying that we've nearly doubled the amount of neglect and abuse in foster care because we're putting extra pressure on the foster parents?
Chair Richardson.
They're just breaking, and so now they're going to start abusing and neglecting their kids at nearly at twice the rate that they were 2 years ago?
Well, one thing, Chair Richardson, is keep in mind that these percentages are all below 1%. This is a portion of a 1%, and that's one of the things that foster parents have testified to. This is not the majority of our foster homes.
Okay, so it's small. We're talking about just
it's a very small percent.
That, so a movement of, in one or two cases, could have significant.
Because yes.
Well, that's 1% of 7,400 children.
Yes. And Chair Richardson, the other thing about that is if a foster family signed up and said, we will take two children, and then the agency calls and says, we have a sibling group of four. Could you accommodate four? I mean, I think we continue to press on the good hearts of individuals who volunteer to be our foster families, and I think we sometimes feel we are at the breaking point with those foster families.
Do these figures also include abuse within the foster children? Like if you had four different foster kids and one's a 13-year-old?
Chair Richardson, it does include that. It could include the abuse of one child by another child, because that would then get reflected as a supervision issue perhaps on the foster parents' part.
And I would think that would actually be a huge factor because
yes.
It's so difficult. Yes. Senator West.
Well, just two comments, Mr. Chair. One is back when we got to the Uniform Crime Reporting Standards, all of a sudden we nationalized and supposedly routinized all of the crime reporting statistics in the various categories, and as we went from state to state, we found, you know, all of a sudden some states were having incredibly high rape, murder, felony drug convictions, and it wasn't that those rates were actually skyrocketing in those states, it was that they were actually reporting the crimes, but more importantly, for the comparison purposes, they were reporting them differently in the various states. So I don't know if any of this is going on, Ramona, but the other thing, and this, I don't think we can underestimate this. Meth is epidemic, and it is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily a West Coast phenomenon. So when we start looking at comparing to national averages in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California, well, California is not. I think we're, when we compare us to national averages, we're not factoring in a substantial contributor to part of our problem, which is one word, methamphetamine. It is huge in what these folks deal with every day. I don't think we can dismiss the impact of meth on everything they do.
Including incidents of neglect in foster care?
Sure, because sure. If you're having more methamphetamine use out, you know, with otherwise normal parents, I mean, drug-addicted parents, remember the dopamine level. I mean, food was 150 and alcohol was like 300, heroin and cocaine was 600 or 700. Methamphetamine was 1,100. So if you've got more folks coming into the system because of a incredibly addictive drug and you're trying to push more kids into a fairly static number of foster care, you're going to get what is really a fractional increase here. How many cases does that near doubling represent? What would that give me a round number? I'm not saying that's good, don't get me wrong. I mean, I agree with Representative Hanna. Zero is the standard.
30 to 40.
Out of 7,000. I mean,
I guess 1% of 7,400
is 74. 74, so half.
So 40 yeah. to 80% is.
And they put a multiple child placement with one wrong parent, you've got two or three. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to make apologies, but it's, you've got to look at this with all of the kind of the data included.
What I'm focusing on is changes in trends.
Yeah.
You know, and so anytime something almost doubles in 1 year, it could be some catastrophic situation, or it could be an indication of a problem. We don't want to get 2 or 3 years and see that it's continued and not having, you know, addressed. Just trying to see if there's a reason.
We're trying to put more sardines in the can, and we're damaging the sardines. I mean, I don't want to put it that way. But
Mr. Chair, I think that what we're seeing is what some of us said last session and previous sessions. This discussion about methamphetamine started in 99. I know it did with me, and we're seeing that it has escalated to the point of being epidemic. The agencies have been talking about it, its impact not only on foster care, and you combine this drug epidemic with us being one of the highest unemployment states in the nation. You just take all of these factors, and it's always been, you know, if you can follow history and the trend lines, in normal recessions, the agencies like child welfare, their statistics will go up, because when you put these kinds of pressures onto families, you know, a lot of things happen. And you combine that now with this new phenomenon of methamphetamine, it has just sent agency statistics out of the roof. And I think you're going to hear that consistently from not only child welfare perspective, but I think the other agencies, when they come in, it's going to be a familiar theme of the impact of drug and alcohol in this, the substance abuse in this state, and you can not only link it to here, but you can link it to our prison population. It's a reality that we're going to have to face and address.
Absolutely. Can we continue this until tomorrow?
We can. Yes.
Are there questions that we would like to take the next minute on what has been brought up to this point?
Not a question. I'd like to give a kudos. because we seldom do that, but I'd like to give a kudo, because if you got your comparison stats that they gave us and look to what the our state is doing and compared to national comparisons on the TANF and jobs, we're ahead of, our percentage is ahead of Alaska, Idaho, and Washington. If I look at prevention of teen birth that we discussed yesterday, you know, we're right in there. We can probably a little work on Washington, but, I mean, we're there. And if I look at the TANF cases per 1,000, Laura is better, and we're 5.1 compared to Washington's 8.9. So I think I'm glad that we asked for those.
Thank you very much. This information is very helpful because it gives us kind of a benchmark we can kind of look at, and so we appreciate very much the timely presentation of this information and all that you've given us today. And thank you very much for your presentations. And Senator Wessel.
Sorry, you were talking.
No, that's right. We're just about to wrap this up.
I'd just like to offer that this is, I think, one of the best examples any of us can get as to where government is not a business. It's fine, and I know many of us try to do this, run it more effectively, more efficiently, try to provide more service with less dollars. That's one discussion. But the concept of government as a business is false. And this is the perfect example of when, you know, the economy gets rough, unemployment goes up, drug use becomes more prolific, there's more spousal abuse, I mean, on and on and on. Government costs go up. The requirement of government is increased. And this is the perfect example. I think their budget is.
Representative Hansen, before we depart.
Two quick things. I don't know if I will get to them tomorrow or at what point. But I think to help us understand the nature of everything we're doing, a comparison between how great of a problem is alcohol abuse compared to methamphetamine abuse, especially in terms of out-of-home placements or neglect issues or anything you'd have to help us set those things. The other thing, and I think it was just briefly alluded to earlier, you said there were few resources for alcohol and drug treatment. And I'd like to know how severe the shortage of treatment is in terms of if we're dealing with a meth epidemic, which I'm sure we are, and is there a shortage of treatment opportunities?
And what's the percentage? Inpatient, or does that include like the equivalent for Alcohol Anonymous?
Well, no, I think we're talking about inpatient there. Okay. Outpatient, and probably there's comparison for both inpatient and outpatient.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We will adjourn for the day.
But, you know, it's all over the map. Moving through.